You're listening to Precinct 444, a podcast network from the National Law Enforcement Museum. Today we're bringing you an episode from Law and Disorder, where we dive into the world of true crime stories with memorable cases that have lasting effects for law enforcement. Today we're bringing you an episode from Law and Disorder, where we dive into the world of true crime stories with memorable cases that have lasting effects for law enforcement. We're returning to Anna Muckenfuss, our museum's Manager of Programs and Education Initiatives, who brings us part two of The People vs. O.J. Simpson.
On January 24, 1995, The People vs. O.J. Simpson officially began in a courtroom in downtown Los Angeles. Television cameras placed intricately throughout the space allowed the world a crystal-clear view of every aspect of the scene, allowing for intimate shots of tearful witnesses describing the terror that Nicole Brown Simpson experienced in her marriage with O.J., to close-ups as the defendant scoffed at the prosecution's accusations that his years of domestic violence toward his ex-wife culminated in her murder. The striking visuals of emotional characters, shocking language, and dramatic jury dismissals made for quite the media circus, and the 134-day-long trial was broadcast live on Court TV. Between 1994 and 1997, the trial proceedings would be the subject of 2,237 news segments. This is Law and Disorder. My name is Anna Muckenfuss, and today we're going back to those 134 days in 1995, where the world witnessed what would be regarded as the trial of the century, The People versus O.J. Simpson. We'll start with the opening statements, walk through some of the sensational testimony, and then break down the cases of both the defense and prosecution, and then talk about the verdict that continues to divide the world. The trial began with a flourish that anyone would expect. The trial was actually meant to start on January 23rd, but things did not go so smoothly when Judge Ito called the court into order. Explosive arguments between attorneys for the defense and the prosecution erupted, stalling any progress toward opening statements. The attorneys' arguments further escalated after the defense made a rather unusual and bold request of the judge. They want to begin the trial by having the defendant, O.J., directly address the jury, with no opportunity for cross-examination. The Dream Team wanted to give Simpson the opportunity to tell his side of the story in his own words. He was a charismatic man, after all. And in addition to this odd request, they also wanted O.J. to be able to show the jurors a number of scars from surgeries he'd undergone to repair damage from injuries sustained during his football career. The defense argued that Johnny Cochran's opening statement would be far more effective if O.J. was able to simultaneously show the jury the scars while his attorney shared the narrative of the defense's case. A cornerstone of the defense's case was built on the assertion that Simpson was physically incapable of committing the murders with which he was charged. Understandably, the prosecution vehemently argues with this request. The action the defense wants to take feels like showmanship, and if Simpson wants to talk to the jury, he should be on the list to take the stand like everyone else, because naturally, the prosecution has many questions they would like to ask Simpson about with this case, when he's sworn to tell the truth and nothing but the truth. So help him God. The back and forth sets opening statements for the trial back an entire day, marking the official start of the trial as January 24th. Judge Ito denies the defense's request to allow Simpson to address the jury directly without the opportunity for cross-examination, but he does give the defense permission to allow Simpson to show surgery scars during Cochran's opening statements. Court is adjourned and set to reconvene the next day. The prosecution is first in opening statements. Prosecuting attorney Christopher Darden is the first to speak, and he paints the picture for the jury that beneath Simpson's star-studded image as a celebrity, he was a jealous batterer and ultimately a murderer. He tells the jury, "He killed her, Nicole, out of jealousy. He killed her because he couldn't have her." He referred to Simpson as a controlling and possessive man, driven by obsessive love. He then described the 17 years of physical and emotional abuse that Simpson subjected Nicole to, which ultimately resulted in their divorce and culminated in her murder. Then it was Deputy District Attorney Marcia Clark's turn to address the jury. She presents the evidence against Simpson to the jurors and how it all connected together with the prosecution's theory that it was a long history of domestic violence which led to Nicole Brown Simpson's death, and poor timing brought Ronald Goldman to his ultimate demise. It was Simpson's abuse of Nicole that had led to the couple's divorce. After all, he had pled guilty to the domestic abuse charge back in 1989. The prosecution lays out how they believe the night of the murders played out. On the night of the murders, Simpson attended a dance recital for his daughter, an event that Nicole also attended. He was irritated by Nicole because of a black dress that she wore. He claimed it was too tight. Simpson was further angered by the fact that after the recital, Nicole and her family went to dinner together at Mezzaluna, the restaurant where Ronald Goldman worked, and they had not invited him. It was at Mezzaluna that Nicole's mother accidentally left her glasses, prompting Goldman's arrival to Nicole's home. He had offered to bring the glasses home after his shift ended. The envelope containing Nicole's mother's glasses was found by investigators near Goldman's body. Clark discusses the trail of, quote-unquote, blood where there should be no blood, that stretched from Bundy Drive, the scene of the murders, through Simpson's Bronco, and all the way back to Simpson's Rockingham estate, as the devastating proof of his guilt. Before the defense could even begin their opening statement, the drama continued to ensue in the courtroom, as Judge Ito had to suddenly suspend live television coverage after Court TV accidentally televised the face of an alternate juror. Judge Ito announced that the next day he would be reconsidering his initial decision to allow continued television coverage of the trial. The same day the defense will begin presenting its case. January 25th, the Dream Team addresses the jury for the first time, describing their defendant as an innocent man and former football legend who was being wrongfully accused by a prosecution that is determined to win this case at any cost. Johnny Cochran's opening statement began shortly after Judge Ito decided to allow the television coverage of the trial to continue, and he gave viewers quite a show. Cochran's opening statement centered around the prosecution's rush to judgment and accusations that investigators ignored at least two witnesses who offered information that could have cleared Simpson. This included a woman who claimed she saw four men walking near the murder scene on the night of June 12th, and another who saw OJ's car parked in front of his home that night. During the opening statements, Simpson shows the jury scars from his knee operations, just as Judge Ito had allowed him to do the day before. After Cochran's opening statements concluded, the court erupted into yet another round of bitter arguments. The prosecution requested that some of the comments Cochran made during his opening statements be struck from the record, while also accusing the defense of serious misconduct, citing that they were ambushed by names and statements of witnesses they hadn't been made aware of until the defense was well into their opening statements. Judge Ito agreed to strike these comments from the record and instructed the jury to disregard information from those comments as they considered the case. But this wasn't quite enough for the prosecution, who requested that Judge Ito also tell the jury that the defense had engaged in misconduct, and he give the prosecution the opportunity to make a second opening statement, and that the rest of the trial be delayed for 30 days so that the prosecution could prepare. Exasperated, Ito adjourned court for the day, stating that he would consider his decision regarding the prosecution's requests until Monday, but told the defense to be prepared to finish their opening statements on Monday, and told the prosecution to prepare to call their first witness if he decided to allow the trial to proceed immediately. Ultimately, Judge Ito did allow for the trial to continue, and witnesses began their testimony promptly on January 31st, 1995. The first witness to be called by the prosecution was LAPD dispatcher Sharon Gilbert. Her testimony brought the court back in time to January 1st, 1989, the night O.J. Simpson had been accused of severely beating his then-wife Nicole Brown Simpson, an accusation he pled no contest to in court later that year. But he never served a sentence for it. The prosecution wants to go back to the beginning for the jury and go through the history of domestic violence that OJ had inflicted upon Nicole. Gilbert's testimony painted a grim picture of the realities of OJ and Nicole's relationship. She recounted a 911 call where she could audibly hear a woman in the background being beaten and begging for help. She put out a radio call for officers in the West Los Angeles area to travel toward Simpson's fashionable Brentwood neighborhood and investigate the situation. The next two witnesses would further describe to the jury the events of that January 1st incident. Detective John Edwards described arriving to the scene and speaking with Nicole about what had happened. He described how Nicole was trembling and fearful, telling officers at the scene, "He's going to kill me," as she cried. When given the opportunity to cross-examine Detective Edwards, Johnny Cochran suggested to the detective, "Might Nicole have been drunk that night?" And even asked if he believed that her injuries could have been consistent with the mutual wrestling match that OJ insisted the couple had engaged in during that evening. Detective Edwards stood firm in his assertion that Nicole was not in fact drunk and insisted that she was afraid of her husband and the threat of losing her life. Next on the stand was LAPD detective and former friend of OJ and Nicole's, Ron Shipp. He'd met Simpson for the first time as a 16-year-old at an all-star football dinner where OJ was speaking as a recent Heisman Trophy winner. OJ had played football against Ron's brother Michael, and OJ had even called Ron out in his speech, stating, "I know if Ron is any kind of athlete like Mike, he must be a great athlete." Ron recalled his introduction to OJ with Vanity Fair 22 years after Nicole's death, and he even discussed his reintroduction to the football star a few years later, after Ron had become a police officer with the LAPD. He discussed going to Nicole and OJ's wedding and recalling having no idea at the time that there was any trouble in the couple's relationship. He would find out soon enough, immediately after the January 1989 incident. He had been at the Rose Bowl game, and OJ's good friend and marketing manager approached him. The friend was Mike Ornstein, a man who would later be convicted of defrauding the NFL. He told Shipp that OJ had gotten himself in a little bit of trouble. OJ and his wife had gotten in a little tiff, as he described it. It hadn't been the juice's fault, but he felt that things got blown a little bit out of proportion. Knowing Shipp was an officer with the LAPD, OJ wanted Ron to poke around and find out if he was a wanted man. And when Shipp arrived at the station the next morning, his colleagues knew he was friends with Simpson, and they were quick to approach him, especially the investigators who had arrived first at the scene. They described how they had allowed Simpson to go upstairs and change before they planned to take him to the station and ask him a few questions. But Simpson had taken the retreat to his room as an opportunity to slip out the side door and drive off, effectively evading booking the night of the incident. Later, this knowledge would infuriate Shipp when he learned that OJ's main defense was that he was being framed for the murders by the LAPD. Shipp asserted that LAPD officers loved OJ. They would have chased him down and booked him the night of the incident with Nicole if they didn't admire him. The fact that OJ and his attorneys believed that the LAPD would frame OJ felt like a slap in the face. Shipp was testifying against his friend, and that was not a decision he made lightly. During pretrial proceedings, he had actually been approached by Johnny Cochran and the Dream Team to testify on OJ's behalf, but Shipp had asserted he wanted nothing to do with the trial. He remembered Nicole coming into the station and confiding to him about the abuse she had sustained from OJ, showing him photos her sister had taken of previous injuries she'd suffered at his hand. Hearing her heartfelt pleas to him for help, the glittering image of the couple he thought he knew was suddenly shattered. Years later, when he learned of Nicole's death through a page from his mother, he was heartsick, and he immediately knew OJ had committed the crime. He called Rockingham to check on OJ, but it was Detective Mark Furman who answered the phone. He asked Furman if he believed OJ was guilty, to which Furman replied, "I can't tell you that," and Shipp was so angry that he eventually hung up the phone on Furman. He called up OJ's home later that day, and even saw him in person the same afternoon he returned from Chicago. From years on the force, he knew that typically in a stabbing, the perpetrator will suffer cuts as well. From years on the force, Shipp knew that typically in a stabbing, the perpetrator is going to suffer cuts from their act of the crime. and he immediately noticed the bandage on OJ's left hand. In front of the group that had assembled at Rockingham before Ship arrived, he asked OJ about the bandage on his hand and said OJ couldn't look at him as he answered. He said, while watching the three TVs he'd assembled to watch news coverage about the case, that he'd cut it on a glass in Chicago. Ship didn't buy it, especially when he heard OJ change his story when he was asked about the injury two additional times that evening. Ship knew without a doubt that his friend had killed Nicole, and after some strong convincing by prosecuting attorney Chris Darden, he took the stand and shared his perspective with the jury, creating a solid connection between the incident of January 1st, 1989 and the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson on June 12th, 1994. Others would take the stand to testify about OJ's abuse of Nicole, notably Nicole's sister Denise Brown. She had been the one to take the photos of Nicole's injuries that Nicole had shown to Ron Shipp after the January 1st incident. Her tearful account of her sister's suffering in her marriage, at the hands of a man so beloved by the public that she believed no one would believe her if she ever came out with her allegations, struck a chord with viewers and echoed the all-too-familiar fears of the victims of domestic violence throughout history and today. But there were many more witnesses that could bolster the prosecution's assertion of Simpson's guilt in the murder of his ex-wife than just his history of domestic violence. Hearing about OJ's abuse of Nicole certainly proved his motivation for committing the crime, but that doesn't prove that OJ was at the condo on Bundy Drive on June 12th. However, the presence of physical evidence can, and the absence of certain pieces of evidence can help to build upon the suspicion held against the accused. The most damning of that physical evidence was blood left at the scene, blood from the perpetrator, a pair of blood-stained leather gloves, and bloody footprints from a pair of shoes that no one could seem to find. A fairly new kind of forensic evidence had been introduced by 1995 that specifically relates to blood evidence, and evidence in the form of other bodily fluids, DNA analysis. In 2022, we think of DNA and forensic science as going hand in hand, but in 1995, it was still in its infancy. The first time DNA evidence was presented in an American courtroom was in 1986, after the same experimental methods of DNA analysis had been successfully presented in a British courtroom and led to the conviction of a man accused of murdering two teenage girls. The O.J. Simpson trial was the first time many of the general public had ever heard of the extent of DNA analysis, and it was quite a high-profile case to use as an introduction. Shows like CSI, which create the illusion that a DNA sample can be injected into a few test tubes, plugged into a computer, and the photo of the perpetrator can pop up in seconds on a screen, these have yet to exist. We know about blood types, we know about blood-borne diseases. The AIDS crisis is still very much in its peak at the time of the O.J. Simpson trial, but we really don't know much about DNA. It made sense for law enforcement to be able to match someone's blood type to the type of a sample found at a scene, but to be able to pinpoint the exact person the blood came from based upon the same blood sample, it honestly felt invasive, like something that would come out of George Orwell's dystopian novel 1984. Genetic codes are something that only a fictional entity like Big Brother can mastermind. It isn't something that a crime lab in Los Angeles, California can just decipher with a few simple laboratory tests. Multiple witnesses are called to testify about the improvements in DNA analysis technology, the processes by which both blood samples from the crime scene and known samples collected by investigators from a suspect are synthesized and compared. These witnesses would also discuss how the 108 individual pieces of DNA evidence that were introduced in the case were collected, packaged, and handled, both at the scene and in the crime lab during the extent of the investigation. They also testified that blood drips found near both Nicole and Goldman's bodies and on the back gate at Bundy Drive, which is the crime scene, blood in OJ's Bronco, and trails of blood in the Rockingham Estate's foyer and master bedroom were perfect matches to Simpson's. Members of Simpson's defense would berate these witnesses on the stand. Defense attorney Barry Scheck's cross-examination of criminalist Dennis Fung lasted 9 days, and during Scheck's aggressive questioning, Fung's answers came off as incredibly confusing to the jury, causing the prosecution to scramble to explain his answers. To those with a legal and forensic background, DNA evidence seemed fairly easy, even straightforward to understand. But to the layman of the jury, DNA evidence was confusing and overwhelming. Then came the accusations of poor handling of evidence by the LAPD criminalists, and even the tampering of collected samples. Simpson's defense leaned heavily on the presence of a preservative called ethylene diamine tetraacetic acid, more commonly known as EDTA, which was found in 2 of the 108 samples. Ironically enough, it was the prosecution, not the defense, who asked that the samples be tested for the preservative. When the results returned, the defense had a field day. EDTA is a naturally occurring chemical in blood, and Marcia Clark even had Dr. Frederick Reuters, a forensic toxicologist, who asserted that the levels of EDTA in the 2 samples in question was higher than normal, and that it probably came from the reference vials that contained the samples. Read out an excerpt of an Environmental Protection Agency article on EDTA that stated what normal levels of EDTA in blood are. This is something he referenced during his testimony when he was called up to the stand by the defense. Naturally, he misread the article during his cross-examination, which further confused the jury and left them questioning the prosecution's analysis of the evidence. The defense would go on to assert that if the DNA evidence was tampered with by the EDTA, what other evidence could have been mishandled by the investigators? And furthermore, what kind of people would these investigators have to be to plan evidence against a man like O.J. Simpson? O.J. was beloved by the public. What would motivate someone to frame him for murder? Attorneys cited negligence on the part of law enforcement to locate the murder weapon and bloodied clothes belonging to the perpetrator. Looking at the scene, it was impossible to believe that the perpetrator would have walked away from the scene clean of blood. The medical examiner who performed the autopsies on Nicole and Ronald Goldman's bodies testified that both experienced severe and incredibly bloody injuries that were inflicted upon them while they were still conscious. This means that active circulation would have exacerbated the bleeding. Ronald Goldman had been stabbed 22 times, once in the jugular, a major vein that, if punctured, can cause a person to bleed to death rather rapidly. Additionally, the laceration to Nicole's neck was so severe that not only did it sever her carotid artery, but her larynx was visible through the gaping wound, and her C3 vertebrae had been excised. That injury alone had left her nearly decapitated in her assault, and a severely punctured carotid artery can cause death in merely minutes. The prosecution called limousine driver Alan Parks to the stand, the man who had driven O.J. to the airport for his red-eye flight to Chicago the night of the murder. He asserted that he helped O.J. to load his luggage into the car, but there was a single bag that Simpson refused to allow Parks to handle, both at the house, when he placed the bags in the trunk, and when they arrived at the airport. Could that bag have contained the bloody clothes and murder weapon? To this day, that bag has never been found. Neither has the murder weapon or the clothing in question. Then it was the gloves that were taken into consideration. Remember, it had been Mark Furman who found the glove behind the Rockingham guesthouse. He had been investigating the source of 3 loud thumps that OJ's house guest Cato Kalin had heard while on the phone with a friend just after the time the prosecution claims the murders had occurred. The glove's partner was found at the Bendy Drive scene, and Furman's discovery at Rockingham, paired with the fact that he did not have a warrant to search Simpson's property at the time the glove was found, became a very large point of contention to the prosecution's case, according to the defense. It is at this point that Johnny Cochran requests to Judge Ito that O.J. be allowed to try on the gloves that are being used as evidence against him in this case. He claims that if the gloves do not fit Simpson, it is impossible for him to have worn them during the murders. Reluctantly, Judge Ito agrees, and it is at this moment that Johnny Cochran utters his most infamous phrase to the jury, "If it doesn't fit, you must acquit." O.J. puts on quite a performance, donning the black leather isotoner gloves in front of the jury. He tugs at the leather fabric, stiffened by dried blood and storage in an evidence locker. pulling faces that illustrate his struggle. He manages to squeeze his hands in the gloves, which now fit poorly, something his defense attorneys knew would happen based upon the condition of the gloves and OJ's lack of taking his prescription to eliminate swelling in his joints from arthritis. He presents his hands and the gloves to the jury with a shrug. Johnny Cochran gives him a vindictive smile. With a seed of suspicion now sown in the collective mind of the jury, the Dream Team delivers their most damning accusation of the trial. They claim to the jury their belief that Detective Mark Furman plotted to frame O.J. Simpson for the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman because O.J. is a black man and Detective Furman is a racist. Detective Furman is one of the first witnesses to be called in the trial. He first takes the stand for the prosecution in early March. He answers questions from the prosecution about his experience being dispatched with fellow investigators Tom Lang and Philip Van Adder to inform Simpson of the murder of his ex-wife Nicole, and to escort him to the station to pick up the two children he'd shared with Nicole, who had been asleep in her condominium at the time of her murder. During cross-examination by the defense, attorney F. Lee Bailey first presents his theory regarding how Furman planted the glove at the Rockingham scene. He believed that Furman found the glove at the Bundy crime scene, picked it up with a stick, and placed it in a plastic bag. Then he claims that Furman stashed the bagged glove in his sock and drove to Simpson's home with his fellow investigators, where he then planted the glove. He then suggested that the detective's motivation for the planting of the evidence is twofold. The first being that the planting was racially motivated, but the second was that Furman wanted to ensure that he was the hero of what was sure to be a highly publicized case. But the culmination of his cross-examination was when Bailey asked Detective Furman whether he had used a racial slur in the last 10 years. Most specifically, the notorious N-word in referring to African Americans. Furman vehemently denies this allegation on the stand, under oath. Satisfied with his initial testimony, the defense ceases its questioning of Furman, but a later discovery by the defense turns out to be a smoking gun in their case. The defense discovers a series of taped recordings of interviews between Detective Furman and an author named Laura McKinney, recorded 8 years prior to his testimony in Judge Ito's courtroom. In the 13 hours of recorded audio, Furman repeatedly uses the N-word a total of 41 times. A term he claimed, under oath, not to have said in the past 10 years. The defense is elated by this discovery, and they motion to play excerpts of the tapes allowed for the court. They also want to call Furman back on the stand to ask him why he lied to the jury, and further press their previous assertion that Furman framed Simpson for the murders. Judge Ito agrees that the defense can play excerpts of the tapes in court, and recall Detective Furman to the stand for further questioning, but the jury is not going to be present. However, the playing of the tapes and re-examination of Detective Furman on the stand was televised, marking a sensational and historic turning point in the trial. At the advice of his attorney, as he now faced potential charges of perjury, Furman pled the fifth when he took the stand for a second time on September 6, 1995. The focus of the trial for the public was very quickly diverted from Simpson and the question of his guilt in the murders being tried, and it then fell upon Detective Furman. Furman's law enforcement career was widely considered to be over the moment those tapes were introduced in court, whether the jury actually heard them or not. The trial continued for a little over a month after the Furman tapes were introduced. The jury, who had now heard 134 days worth of dramatic testimony and incessant bickering between the attorneys of the defense and prosecution, were finally sent to deliberate. It took them only 4 hours to come back with a verdict that would shock and divide the world. Orenthal James Simpson was found not guilty. The Dream Team celebrated with their defendant. The juice was officially loose on October 13, 1995. Many among the general public, particularly white women, believed O.J. Simpson got away with murder. The case may have been over in a criminal court, but civil trials were held. O.J. was sued by both the Goldman and Brown families for their role in... The case may have been over in criminal court, but civil trials were held. O.J. was sued by both the Goldman and Brown families for his role in their loved ones' untimely deaths, and he was found liable in both cases, and served a settlement of $33.5 million to be owed to both families. Neither family would receive any of that money, but the Goldman family would eventually earn rights to all of Simpson's published works and any profits, most specifically Simpson's 2007 memoir titled If I Did It, in which he explains in grim detail how he would have committed the murder of his ex-wife and Ronald Goldman had he done it. Facing astronomical legal fees in both criminal and civil trials, including settlements to the Brown and Goldman families, O.J. faced an incredible financial debt, and he was forced to sell many of his numerous awards and memorabilia from his football career. On September 16, 2007, O.J. was arrested for conspiracy to commit armed robbery after he and accomplices attempted to intercept what he believed to be a deal to sell some of his memorabilia that he believed had been stolen from him. Simpson was arrested, tried, and found guilty on October 3, 2008, sentenced by Judge Jackie Glass in a Las Vegas courtroom to a maximum sentence of 33 years on charges that included armed robbery and even kidnapping. During the robbery, he had ordered that no one leave the room, which justified the kidnapping charge. Many believe the sentence handed down for the armed robbery was too harsh for the crime that he had actually committed. Some speculate this was a way for Judge Glass to feel that O.J. did serve some time for the death of Nicole and Ronald Goldman. Regardless of the reason, Simpson served 9 years in prison before being released on parole on October 1st, 2017. You can now find The Juice sharing his opinions about current events with short videos on Twitter. Today, investigators of the People vs. O.J. Simpson, as well as the Goldman and Brown families, continue to assert their conviction that O.J. was responsible for the deaths of Ron and Nicole. Artifacts from the investigation of the murders live in our collection at the National Law Enforcement Museum, donated graciously by Detective Tom Lang, who regularly speaks publicly about the case. Countless documentaries and podcasts about the case and its legacy have been released since the verdict was read on October 13, 1995. Both the Brown and Goldman families work to spread awareness and support for the victims of domestic violence, homicide, and their families, and it's a valiant effort that ensures that neither Nicole's nor Ronald Goldman's death would be in vain. Law and Disorder's coverage of the People vs. O.J. Simpson is dedicated to Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman, and in encouragement of the valiant work of their families. This has been Law and Disorder, and we hope you'll join us for our next case.
Thanks to Anna Muckenfuss for writing, researching, and sharing this story, and thanks to Christopher Mitchell for producing. And many thanks to you for listening to this episode of Law and Disorder, a Precinct 444 podcast from the National Law Enforcement Museum. We hope you enjoyed this episode and will join us again for another story of law and disorder. Please subscribe to Precinct 444 on your favorite podcasting platform to stay connected and to receive our latest content as soon as it drops. And we would love to hear from you. Send in your questions, comments, and feedback to precinct444@nleomf.org. You can help us make our content even better. The National Law Enforcement Museum is located at 444 E Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., and is dedicated to telling the story of American law enforcement. We expand and enrich the relationship between law enforcement and the community through educational journeys, immersive exhibitions, and insightful programs. Find us online at lawenforcementmuseum.org and stay tuned for more podcast content from Precinct 444. Until next time, stay safe. We'll see you at the precinct.